Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
We'll be right back.
Hi, hello. It is 29 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of January in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson. The thing
fail.
There. That's exactly what that was.
Fail.
Well, let's be honest. After David Lee Roth, everything is a relative fail. Really, how can I measure up to the standards set by the one and only Diamond Dave, Don? How, I ask you? How?
Yo!
There's no way to do it.
I can't do like David Lee Roth sound,
No one can do the David Lee Roth sound. I will say that we are high above the milk packing district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for coming by. It is Friday, and welcome to day 12. If you would like to join it, and by the way, before everybody, because I'm already starting to get emails from people asking about the Lennon Roth thing I played, I'll find the link for that. So a listener named Phil? I believe it was Phil, but I'm not entirely sure, but I think it was, which allows me to say it with a sort of interrogative inflection like that. I believe listener Phil, not Zaphod, as you might think, but Phil, sent me the link to that fight. It was done online by internet-based DJ. So I'll find a link and I'll put that up on my page later on today. But that's like 900 shades of awesome. That's what they did. I don't want to even like passively take credit for that. Really, all I did was like push a button here that plays it. So, in any event, it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. If you'd like to be part of today's program, 503-505-6964. If you'd like to join us and engage with us telephonically about, whatever might be plaguing your mind today, whatever you might want to share with your compatriots, your comrades, your fellow travelers, whatever it is that makes you so very, very special. Me? Yeah, I'm Bruce. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed. That's don@rickemerson.com. And as a special bonus, she's able to get your email today because her internet is working.
It is indeed.
You know why? Unplugged the router, plugged it back in.
I literally don't know why.
I'm telling you why. Because here's what's great about it. I did exactly what technical support would always tell you to do, that you just, and I do this too.
Turn it off, turn it back on.
It's not just that. I unplugged the device, I powered it down, and did a hard reboot. I unplugged it, waited like 30 seconds, which is the thing that I get with hard drives because they got to spin down. You know, but I mean, as things move away from having physical hard drives, by which I mean that more and more things are like flash-based and they have, fewer moving parts. I think that's a thing that's unnecessary. I think they just tell you to do it because by making you have it unplugged for 30 seconds, they avoid having idiot customers just feign unplugging it and plugging it back in. Like, they force you to kind of go, fine, I'll actually... Because you don't ever really unplug it otherwise, because you just assume that it's just some jackass in Bangladesh who's reading something out of a book and he has no idea how to actually fix the problem. And that they're just saying that, just like they'll always say, like, have you restarted the computer? Or just like they'll always say, like, are you leaning on the keyboard with your big fat American elbows? So I unplugged the router, waited 30 seconds, plugged it back in. And then I had no real way to test it because my stuff was sort of working all along. I came in here this morning and I said, hey, have you talked to Thomas Gill, about how to get your thing? And he's just like, it's magically working again.
It's a miracle.
And I almost didn't want to tell you. I almost wanted to just, sort of let it be like a sort of like a post-Christmas bit of magic for you.
I don't want to ruin it for you, but I kind of figured that was probably the case. Because I haven't had any problems with my current Wi-Fi router at home. But the one I had before this, I had to do that like probably at least once a month where there would be something that would go on and I'd have to go and turn it off and then wait and turn it back on. And it's like, oh, look, now there's internet again. But yeah.
The thing about turning something on to fix it, here's why that sucks. A, it means that the item wasn't working to begin with, so you've lost, your productivity and time and maybe you have to start something over again or you got a document that crashes or whatever. But also, that underscores the point. The unplugging as fix drives home exactly how little you know about the thing.
Yeah.
Because, if you could fix it, you'd just fix it. You can't. It's like it goes beyond, like, even having, like a restart or a retry button. You don't even have that. You could just turn the thing completely off and, like, go fix yourself some toast and come back and plug it in. And you're basically just crossing your fingers and hoping that magically time will have fixed the thing while you're in the kitchen.
Yeah, my old Mac, my Power Mac, it would just get really, really slow and wonky. And I would have to just reboot it every once in a while. And the best I could tell was just, like somebody said, it has a memory leak, which made no sense to me at all. It just really seemed to me that really what it was. It would just get tired.
Right. It was just, I'm sick of whatever we're doing
now. Really, you've been using me for way too long, and I just need to rest for a few moments now, please.
It is Friday. Coming up here in just about 10 minutes, we will have the winner of yesterday's Name That Snack round, which was round two, which, by the way, just consisted of a noise. Not even a clue as spoken aloud. It was just me going and crunching into something. So I will reveal the name of the winner here in a second. We'll reveal exactly what snack we were describing. And then he's going to be in the studio here in about 10, 12 minutes to describe, to sort of tell us how it is that he was able to suss out the accurate answer. Because I thought the sound was fairly distinct, but you and Anna Griffin were saying later that you thought that it seemed more distinct to me just because I knew what the thing was.
Yeah, it sounded like just generic crunching, really, to me, but I don't know.
It's all very confusing.
Obviously not.
So that's coming around 10 minutes, and we'll have a round three of Name That Snack, which, by the way, I mean, we're going to... Do you know? Have I shown you? Do you know what round three is?
No.
Because I talked about it with Cheryl last night, but I didn't know if we'd actually discussed it.
I am completely in the dark as to round three at this point.
I'm actually going to... I'm sorry, he's going to be calling it. He won't be... He's going to be calling. So I'll show you the snack item here in just a second. Also coming up today, Corpse Watch, Nazi Watch, which at the last moment I decided not to put on Twitter because I was posting a little like, hey, the Rick Emerson Show starts in mere moments. You know, Corpse Watch, and Big Jim Willie's going to be here in the top five. And then I typed the phrase, and a Nazi Watch. And I thought, that's the sort of thing that is going to be seen by somebody who maybe is not familiar with the program, and it's almost certainly going to be misconstrued. Not like Corpse Watch.
No,
Nazi Watch just seemed
watch.
Like... It seemed like that was going to get me on some sort of a trending list on Twitter that I probably didn't want to be part of. Like, you know, from like the NAACP or like, you know, like the Southern Poverty Law Center or something was going to flag me.
Well, you never know what's going to happen on the thing. A couple of times I mentioned Patrick's gallbladder, and using the word gallbladder would get me these robo tweets from people going, you need information about gallbladders? We can send it to you. And I was like, how do you know? And you have some kind of like robotic
right.
thing just waiting for someone to mention the word gallbladder.
It's like when you go to a website where you've never been before, and then you discover later that this is based on things you purchased elsewhere, but they are miraculously suggesting exactly the products you want. You're like, you go there, well, that's exactly what I came here to buy. How did you know? And it just sort of, it's that moment where you realize the internet really just is some sort of magical oracle, you know, that realizes things about you that not even you know about yourself.
Yes.
So we got round three of Name That Snack coming up today. Corpse Watch, Nazi Watch, Big Jim Willig will be here with Humor Meat Comedy 101. Today he will be talking about the life and career of Mr. Lewis Black. And we got some audio on that as well. Was it on the air? Was it off the air that I think you actually asked the question of why he was Big Jim?
I think that was on the air.
It was because it was like his...
Because his dad was Big Jim, but then he got bigger than Big Jim. So he became Big Jim and his dad just became Jim.
Was it a size thing? He became physically bigger than his dad?
Yeah, physically larger than his dad.
It was like a handing off of the... Now, little man, I give the big to you.
Yeah.
All right. So Jim Willig here with Humor Me Comedy 101. Today we'll also do the top five. The great Wheel of Time has landed on a truly horrific week for American music. November 5th, 1988. It was a glorious week, Don. Really.
I'm just going to like glue all the pages from the 80s together so you can't go there anymore.
Man, can we just take a moment to talk about how great and glorious yesterday's top five was? I mean, really, just in terms of comedy. I mean, you actually had to go move your car at one point because you wanted to avoid the towing. And really, Anna Griffin was just... She was just knocking them out, like, one after another. She really picked up your baton very, very well while you were out of the room. So, yesterday's top five was, I found it especially amusing. I mean, it was worth the two-day wait. Today, though, we'll get to the top five songs, November 5th, 1988. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
A homeless man becomes instantly famous because of
his radio voice.
His amazing radio voice.
I've totally seen that.
The most popular dog names of 2010 are released. And the Pentagon repatriates a Gitmo prisoner against his will.
What is repatriates means? Is that sends back to his home country?
Yes.
I thought that was just deported.
No, deported is when you send someone out of your country because you are like, don't like them anymore. Repatriate is kind of when you send somebody back, like with no hard feelings, like...
Oh,
hey, you get to go home now.
And I guess being deported, they could send you anywhere.
Right.
They could just like send you to. They could just send you to Wales.
Maybe.
Okay. By the way, I hold here in my hands. This is the item for Name That Snack, round three.
Ooh.
Right there.
Mmm.
All right.
So name that snack. Round three coming up, brought to you by EH Vending, as is a large portion of today's program. EH Vending can be reached at ehvending.com. You can talk to Joshua or James if you are the owner, operator, or decision maker at a small business or a business of any kind or size, and you want to have your vending operations taken care of, or you want to switch vendors, or you want to have your vending operations upgraded to a finer class of company. You can contact them via ehvending.com. So we'll have round three of Name That Snack coming up later on. So that is everything that's on the way today. Corpse Watch, Nacho Watch, Jim Willig with Humor Me, and we'll do the top five as well, and the aforementioned stories, and so forth. And this is all true, and whatnot. Mm. Okay, there we go. I have no segue except to say bumper sticker.
Yes.
Because I know that we were getting ready to do the show today, and you mentioned that you wanted to say something about a bumper sticker you saw on the way in.
Yeah, and you're probably the same way. You're driving in your car, and you see something, whether it's a sign on a building or it's a bumper sticker, and there's just something about it that sets you off, and your brain just starts spinning out of control.
Right.
And it's like, the one I saw this morning, I'm driving here to work, and there is someone in front of me, and they have a bumper sticker on the car that merely says, "Trust Jesus." Now, there are a lot of bumper stickers that like proselytize, that are trying to get a point across. Like,
right.
They'll say, you know, believe in God, Jesus saves, you should go to church. It's like they're actually trying to either... They ostensibly are trying to teach you something, but really it's just a way of the person kind of showing off and going, "Ooh, I'm Christian." But this one really bothered me because it was just idiotic. Because if you already believe in Jesus, of course you trust Jesus.
Did they specify what you were supposed to be trusting him with, like your car keys?
Exactly.
Or
it just said
to watch the house while you're in the Bahamas.
Trust Jesus. Now, if you already believe in him, of course you trust him, because who's more trustworthy than Jesus? But if you don't believe in Jesus, the idea of trusting him is just a moot point.
Well, maybe it might be targeted at non-Christian religious people. That's who that bumper sticker is probably for. That, and I mean Jews, of course, or perhaps Muslims. So the bumper sticker might be targeted at people of a religious bent who are not following Christianity, who believe in Jesus but do not follow Jesus, do not trust him. In other words,
okay. So this person,
Jews, for example, believe in Jesus, and so do Muslims, but they don't believe that he was the Son of God.
So the person with this car was specifically concerned about people out there who may somehow think that Jesus is a little shady.
Well, it's like asking you, like, you know, trust Rush Limbaugh. You believe in Rush Limbaugh. You know he exists. You don't trust him, though.
Yes, but I don't think that most people believe... I don't think that there are people who believe that Rush Limbaugh is a mythological being, is what I'm saying. It's sort of like saying, you know, trust Harry Potter, you know, or, you know, trust...
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's targeted at religious people.
Yeah.
Because there are many people who believe in Jesus but don't trust him. Because he's shady.
Is that true,
and a Jew. What?
Is that really true, though?
Is what true?
If you actually believe that Jesus existed or you would have to say exists in some sort of...
Well, the strong likelihood is that Jesus did exist. I believe that he probably existed. Doesn't mean I think he's the Son of God.
But also, that's a present tense statement. Trust Jesus.
Yeah, I know.
So you're trusting him now.
Look, it's not my bumper sticker, sister. Don't... I'm just giving you my... What? Look, I wasn't there. I'm just here. I didn't create it or sell it to the guy. I'm only opining.
All of this is just going through my head where I'm just driving, you know, this is another one of those cases where I just keep thinking, you know, words mean something.
Well, no, I get what you're saying. I mean, I understand that from a certain... I'm not trying to be difficult about it. Here's what I'm doing.
I'm more upset about it grammatically than theologically.
I am trying to, and this is an unfortunate choice of words, I'm trying to be the devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out I guess I'm trying to find... You know what I am in this case, Don? Here's what I am. I am the court-appointed public defender in the case of this bumper sticker, and so you are like, you know, Dan Fielding over there, and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to say that the guy is just a jackass who has no sense of, you know, how to use the King's English or any other form of language, and that he's using, you know, it is technically a sentence because there's a noun and a verb, but that's where the logic stops, and that there is no fundamentally sensical underpinning to the sentence at all. I am trying to find the best case scenario in which, you know, that the bumper sticker could function. I'm trying to find a way in which it makes some sort of logical sense.
That might make some sense somehow.
And the sense that it would make to me is if that bumper sticker was not targeted at you, a non-believer in the existence of Jesus, but if it was targeted at believers in the existence of Jesus who still did not trust him as the Messiah or Son of God. That would make sense. Now, again, not to you, but in that context, the bumper sticker would work. But it would work for its intended purpose.
But that just leads me to wonder if you did believe that Jesus existed, and you do believe that he still exists as some kind of, you know, ghostly presence who looks out over people and you pray to him, then why would you... What do you think he's up to that's making him untrustworthy?
Case in your house, probably watching your shower. I mean, I've always assumed that. Maybe that's just me. I have no better answer.
Yeah, I just had to get that out of my system because that was really
this is one of those
really
things where you've asked the question and I've given you, like, I can tell that it's totally unsatisfying in terms of answers.
Because
it's an itch that can't be scratched.
The real answer is that it's just a badly phrased bumper sticker that someone who believes in Jesus put on their car without really thinking out the logic of what the statement.
Well, I will acknowledge this. I will acknowledge that my angle on the thing, my take on it, is actually correct and sort of works. That is probably not what they intended. That's the thing is, my answer is probably smarter and more accurate than really the guy who came up with the bumper sticker ever would have thought of. That's not a thing that ever entered his head.
Although I like your answer, though, because now I'm intrigued by the idea that there are people out there who believe in Jesus but think he's some kind of ne'er-do-well.
Well, see, and then there's a distinction inside a distinction, the idea that they believe in him in the present tense. Because I think there are probably three categories of people in a broad sense. There are people, well, four. There are people who disbelieve that he exists or ever existed, even as a real person whose story was incredibly conflated and exaggerated over time. There are people, and I would consider myself probably one of these, who think there is probably some basis in reality for the idea that there was a guy, you know, the guy named Yeshua, that there was a man upon whom Jesus Christ was modeled, and that over time, like a game of telephone, the story just became exaggerated, as those things do.
I, too, am of that camp.
Yeah, that there was probably some guy, and then it's like, you know, and I don't know, and he did that thing where it looks like he's sliding the end of his finger off at a party, you know, for the kids, and they went, oh my God, you know, and then he's the Messiah.
He said, got your nose one time too many,
totally.
And everyone was like, oh God, look what he did to the lepers.
And, you know, so there's that. There are people who believe in his existence and believe that he's the Son of God. I can't believe we're having this discussion. By the way, this is just really when I say that your 32 cents buys a lot. Listen to the wondrous variety that your money is obtaining for. Just the other day, we were talking about butt sex, you know, and clowns and the clown butt sex. And so here, Jesus.
We're thoughtful people. We think about a lot of different things.
And then there is a fourth group of people. And because the sort of intriguing thing about this is that Christianity and Islam and Judaism are all very similar. I mean, they're sort of, they are, in fact, they're in their own way, they are kind of a holy trinity because they are three different branches off the same religion. So they are all, they overlap, which is why it's always so hilarious that they keep blowing each other up, you know, because those three religions have more in common than they have that makes them dissimilar. But of course,
well, that's why they're battling for supremacy.
I guess that's true, really, when you think about it, because it's like Lutherans aren't really attacking anybody, you know, and it's like, you know, I mean, Scientologists attack everybody, you know, so it's like, you know, they're at an opposite end of the spectrum altogether.
It's like the Baptists who are like at each other's throat all the time about which version of being a Baptist is the real being a Baptist.
That's the thing. It's like the closer you are to each other, I suppose that's the thing. You're fighting to own that niche. So, so Jews, for example, believe that he was a prophet or a Messiah, but they don't believe he was the Son of God and whatever, which just seems to me like you're splitting hairs there, you know. That's the thing where, if you're going to go 70% of the way, you know, why don't you just go to the... Like, how can you believe that a guy is in fact a prophet, which is to be, you know, a seer, or to have some sort of, you know, prestidigitative ability, but you just can't make, you know, the belief, you know, the leap to the rest of the superstition? It just, the whole thing boggles my mind. I'm just saying, it's just, and I know I'm trying to impose logic on a thing that is fundamentally faith-based and whatever, but it's all very confusing. This is way too heavy for a Friday.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Penis!
Okay. Well, I have something else, though. If I want to jump, or do you want to? Is Rick Rutherford?
Before we do that, we should welcome now to the Rick Emerson program a man of, speaking of prestidigitative abilities. We should welcome listener Rick Rutherford. Hello, sir. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Rick. Good afternoon, Don.
Hiya.
How is your Friday going so far, my friend?
That's awesome. I took today off, so.
Excellent. So you, let me just.
Did you take the day off because you won the contest?
No, I didn't look that far in advance.
Okay, I can't believe I'm having to say this. Sir, I need you to turn your radio down. I need you to, all right. Thank you. Okay, so yesterday we did round two of Name That Snack, and I'm going to recreate the clue here. By the way, so let me just, hold on, let me reach back. And I am going to, God, I'm loath to do this, because here's the thing, I don't like these things very much.
Well, do you want me to do it? Because I'm okay with them.
You want to?
Yeah.
All right, there you go. So we're going to recreate yesterday's auditory
So there's the cellophane.
All right, so Dawn is going to give the sound of crunching this particular item. All right, so there you go. So that is the clue that we had yesterday for round two of Name That Snack. And you know, I said, okay, now if you know the answer, you send it in to snack@rickemerson.com, and the first person to respond, you know, they win a basket of snack items from EH Vending and whatever. And then I swear to God, that was at like, I don't know, like three something. And within, I don't know, like 12 minutes or whatever of doing it, I think Cheryl said that she'd had, first of all, just a massive number of responses, but that you, like immediately, just like from jump, had the correct answer, which is corn nuts. And so my apologies condolences to everybody else who had corn nuts as an answer, but just were not so quick on the draw. My question for you is, how in the name of sweet Christ Almighty did you deduce corn nuts from that noise?
Yeah, actually, it was quick. It was instant, too. It was like 3 Mississippi, and I sent that email. I sent it before you even ate the second corn nut.
Are you kidding me? Really? Before I even tried the second mouthful, you figured it out and sent it in?
Yeah. My sister-in-law, Dee Dee, who I love, she had an issue with corn nuts, and I mean, to the point where she stopped eating them now. I mean, she had to quit. I sat next to her every Saturday for over 10 years at soccer, listening to her eat those infernal things.
Wait, hold on.
I know that noise.
I have to ask. This raises more questions than it answers. Let's back up for a second. Your sister-in-law, Dee Dee, so this is she's an in-law, she's married to your brother or something, and so you're sitting next to her at soccer games. These are like youth soccer games? Or is
exactly.
This, okay. Oh, by the way, that whole smell of the corn nuts has just permeated the studio already.
That's actually one of the reasons I wanted to eat it instead of you eating
it.
Because it's one thing to eat the corn nuts and then smell the corn nuts.
Ugh.
It's another thing for somebody else to eat the corn nuts and then you smell the corn nuts. And yesterday, I was really hating the fact that I could smell the damn corn nuts after you
it's
ate
like
them.
It's like someone else's Mexican food, you know?
I actually, honest to God, really can't smell them now that I ate them myself. But yesterday, smelling them on you was horrible.
Don't get me wrong, because I know a lot of people like corn nuts, and they're one of the many fine snacks offered by EH Vending, their machines. It's like, you know what it is? It's like how you can't smell your own body odor sometimes, but everybody else in the room can. So when you say that you sat next to her for 10 years and she had an issue with corn nuts, what do you mean she had an issue with corn nuts?
She literally had bags of corn nuts stashed all over her house, in her car, everything. I mean, she was an addict, for lack of a better word.
I've known people
who
had that problem.
She was nuts for corn nuts.
And so was this like, did you have to have an intervention or something? Did the whole family have to sit down with her and just, you know, and say, Dexter's out, Dee Dee, you know, and, you know, they had to tell her that she had to knock it off?
I think somebody had a long look in the mirror. Well,
I mean, that's one of those things where it's like, if you're a big corn nut enthusiast, it seems like at a certain point your significant other is either going to have to just become, they're either going to have to share the interest in corn nuts with you, which seems, you know, that's a thing that you either have or you don't. I don't think it grows on you. Or they're probably going to ask you to knock it off because that's, I would say that is a, I mean, just imagine like kissing somebody who's just had a whole bag of corn nuts. I mean, that's a thing I just can't get behind. That seems unpleasant in every way. So long-term exposure to the corn nut crunching sound.
Oh, yeah. As soon as you put it in your, actually the wrapper, that metally kind of wrapper,
right.
I heard that jostling, my ears pricked up. And then as soon as he crunched, my spidey senses went off.
By the way, Dawn is actually on the other side of the studio waving around her pile of news trying to get the corn nut sound to sort of, the corn nut smell to sort of dissipate.
Try to diffuse the corn nut smell.
Speaking of just metallic wrappers, before we go, did anybody ever try, and I think they've already started to take it off the market, we never got a chance to talk about it, it was like here and gone before we could do anything. Did you try that new Sun Chips bag that they had on the market for about a month? And it was like in November. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Because it was out, and then there was a
It had a texture to it almost, the bag, right?
It was a biodegradable bag. Yeah, the whole thing was that it was a bag you could just toss into the street, theoretically, and it would degrade within like a month. That it would just, it would, that it wasn't plastic.
But they had to get rid of it because it was so loud.
It was so goddamn loud.
And it was
the first, my wife and I bought, because we're suckers for like novelty, you know, snacks and, you know, sort of anything like the Three Musketeers Twix thing. And we were like a plaid pantry. And I said, well, that Sun Chips bag looks new. And basically just being a human, you know, like a walking magpie. And I go over and I pick it up and it makes this really, really loud noise. And we ended up buying them just because I have no impulse control. But we noted that the bag was going to be a huge failure. Not because it's just loud as such, but because the loudness of it is going to make it difficult to do secret snacking. That's the thing. You know, because I will do this sometimes, where I'll get up at night and I'm trying to snack really quietly, either to avoid my wife's scorn or to quit, you know, to not wake up the dogs, who will then demand to come out and be fed. So I predicted the thing was going to be a huge failure, and it was like, it was not even on the market like 2-3 weeks. It was like that Gap logo, where like they put it out and like later that same day they just retracted it. But the Corn Nuts bag, you're right. Can you just sort of rustle the bag itself next to the... You're right. It does have a distinctly sort of... It's a crisp sound, the bag. It is like a metallic, like a foily sort of sound.
Yeah, I mean, it jettisoned me to a soccer field in Vancouver instantly I heard that noise.
It was like some sort of a vending flashback.
So hard. And those noisy potato chip bags, that would be perfect for those... volcano chips or whatever it was.
The earthquake chips from yesterday.
Earthquake, yeah.
Well,
I have a question for you, Mr. Rutherford.
Yes.
At Christmas time, you stopped by the... Did you give me a bottle of homebrewed beer?
No, I gave you iPod chargers.
Oh, no, I remember that. I just... Somebody gave me a bottle of homebrewed beer and I drank it last night and I can't remember who gave it to me and it's driving me crazy. So
it must have been strong beer.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you were just drunk and couldn't remember, but all right. Well, congratulations. You will have a en route to you soon will be a bag of Delectable Delights from EH Vending. Mm-hmm. You can find them at ehvending.com. So congratulations, my friend. And I'm glad that you have found, because that's really like a really, really useless superpower that you, against all odds, defying probability, have found a way, you know, in this instance at least, to sort of profit from. So well done on that.
Yeah. I mean, I probably cocked my head and heard like some Indian owl noise or something when it happened because I was there. I was there.
Excellent. Have a good weekend, my friend. Thank you.
Okay, you guys take it easy.
There you go. That's Rick. Awesome. All right. By the way, somebody's saying, hey, have you tried that new mint chocolate chip gum that's out?
I actually have. I was at Cascadia FM. And Robert Wagner had bought some of it at Plaid Pantry.
Why does that exist?
And we were trying. There's this whole line of gum that one of the gum companies is making where tastes like different desserts.
Right.
Like there's a strawberry cheesecake gum and a mint chocolate chip gum. But the thing is, it's mint chocolate chip ice cream. And flavor technology has gotten so creepy and
weird. Does it taste like it?
It does. It does. And there's a coolness to it because of the mint.
Right.
And there's a specific kind of almost a dairy-like flavor to it that it tastes exactly, not just mint chocolate chip. It tastes like mint chocolate chip ice cream.
Now, how about the chocolate part of it, though? Because you'll note that there is no chocolate gum on the market.
Right.
If there's this, that it would be the first one. Because that has been a challenge for science, lo, these many decades.
It tastes exactly like mint chocolate chip ice cream. The problem being, of course, it's still gum.
Right.
And which I don't really like gum.
But I mean, but that's the thing. But again, it's like I was saying, novelty products.
Yeah.
People love that kind of stuff. There is a whole niche, I think, for people who just like something that tastes like something completely different.
But the flavor is uncanny. It really is.
I'll be curious to see if they do that. If they're able to do that, and it sounds like they have. That's like that whole thing where, like, for years, like, the Jones Rose Company or whatever, they couldn't come up with a blue rose.
Yeah.
And then finally, like, I don't know, like, 10 years ago or something, they offered, like, $500,000 to the first person that could create, you know, without scientific meddling, that through hybridization could create a blue rose.
And they would do these lavender ones and these gray ones, and they'd kind of try to pass them off as blue, but they weren't really.
And so the food equivalent of that is synthesizing chocolate, because they've never been able to synthesize the flavor of chocolate accurately. It never tasted real.
There was this Canfield diet soda, used to do a chocolate diet soda, and it just tasted like burnt cardboard.
Yeah, Cragmont made a, here in the Northwest, Cragmont made a chocolate mint soda when I was a kid. It was awful. It was one of the worst things I've ever had in my... It really was just a hot steaming cup of chemicals is what that was in your mouth. Because when I was a kid, I remember in 321 Contact magazine, there was a whole article about this because a kid had written in and he'd asked, he's like, dear 321 Contact, he's like, why is there no chocolate-flavored toothpaste? Which had actually never occurred to me. Because I thought, well, it's a universally loved flavor. Of course there should be chocolate toothpaste. And that's why, because they couldn't. But now, So maybe now the floodgates will open. They'll be chocolate-flavored like everything.
Or maybe just because if it tasted too much like chocolate, your child would just eat the entire tube of toothpaste.
Well, you know, I think about that sometimes, too. Here's a question. So what is it? I think this sounds dumb. I could just look at the toothpaste tube, I suppose. What is it that's in toothpaste that makes it sweet?
It's not
saccharin. It's not Splenda.
No. It's a sugar-free sweetener. I can't remember which one it is.
And why don't they use that in soda? That would be my question. Is like,
I think it's one of the ones that gives you horrible, horrible diarrhea if you eat too much of it.
Ah, I see. Okay, so, that would be a good reason not to consume large quantities of it, I guess.
I remember, this is kind of a horrible story, but my dog, when she was a puppy, she ate an entire sample packet of doggy toothpaste. And I bought it, and it's like meat flavored, but it still has the sugar alcohols in it to make it slightly sweet. And I'd use some of it on her, and then I put it up on a counter, and I hadn't realized she had actually gotten tall enough that she could get her paws and her face up at the top of this counter. And I didn't know she'd eaten it, and we put her back in her, she had a little pen area, and we went to work, and we came home from work at the end of the day. And she had basically just exploded from both ends all over the inside of her enclosure. And she was...
the worst thing ever.
She was sitting in the one clean corner of the pen, just looking sad and embarrassed and miserable. And we felt so sorry for her. It was like, I'm so sorry. But apparently all she had done was just... I mean... it was like up the walls.
Okay.
It was horrible.
Thank you.
So yeah. So
thanks.
You don't want to eat too much of that stuff.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. It is the it's the Rick Emerson. How are we? Okay. Again, this is the second time today this has happened where I look at it. It's like 35 minutes have gone by. Didn't it seem like we just started?
It was all that Jesus talk.
Just now, I was playing that David Lee Roth thing. I swear to God, it was just this second, and now here we are. And we have to do the news here in a second. We'll take a break.
We're having so much fun; it just zips by.
Really, it does. In the blink of an eye, we've gone from all right. So we'll do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back with Jim Willig here in a few. He'll do another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Talk about Louis Black later on. Nazi Watch, Corpse Watch, Top 5, and Name That Snack. Round 3. And there's like a whole pile of things that you and I both have to talk about, but we've had no chance to get to any of it, Don.
Well, do you want to break? Bring Jim in, and then we'll just start talking about everything?
Well...
and just power through?
Well... well, let's do this. Let's do a couple stories here.
Okay.
Then we'll take a break, and just so we can sort of get some a little bit of momentum going here before we break again. We'll do a couple stories. We'll break. We'll come back. We'll talk to Jim, and then everything will roll on flawlessly from that point. Ladies and gentlemen, at the news desk, it's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Saeed Fari had long said he feared being sent back to Algeria. Indeed, after a judge ordered his release in late 2009, Fari said that he would rather spend the rest of his life in Guantanamo than return to Algeria, where he feared Islamic extremist violence and worried about government retaliation for the stigma of having been held at Guantanamo, even though he had been cleared. This is according to the Miami Herald. Fari's attorneys wanted to use the case to question whether the courts could investigate State Department claims that a repatriation would be safe. But the Justice Department insists doing so would infringe on the president's foreign policy powers. Fari's repatriation reduces the number of prisoners at Guantanamo to 173 at a time when Congress has imposed tough new rules on the president, making more difficult to fulfill his promise to shut down the prison.
Every time we talk about Guantanamo, I mean, I have no idea I think the only photos I've ever seen were like where Lindy England or whatever her name was like tasing the guy's junk. That's the only photograph I've seen. I always just picture it looking like Azkaban. I don't know why. I think that's because that's my only, because it's always depicted as being such a horrible place, which probably is, but it's a prison, so what are you going to do? But I think it's just been, it is, whatever the reality is, whether it's awful or somewhat less than awful, it's been depicted as being such a horrible place, I think, by certain sections of the media, that now Azkaban is the only thing I can come up with. You know, where it's just like cloaked dementors just roaming the halls and going, you know, and sucking out all of your hope, you know, as you like sit there in your cell.
Yeah, and I remember that long concrete hallway photograph with the Lindy England thing. And I think, honest to God, I just realized in my brain, I think of the that scene in Silence of the Lambs. Where
she's down, you know, and he's like, yes. It's the long concrete, the weird flagstone walled tunnel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what I imagine it looks like.
It probably does look closer to that and less like Azkaban. I mean, if we're going to be honest about it.
And less Dementors.
Less Dementory, yes.
Mm-hmm. New research appearing in the Journal of the American Medical Association suggests that more than 20% of heart patients with defibrillators don't meet the evidence-based guidelines for implantation.
With what?
Defibrillators. Defibrillators.
That's okay. I apparently said chocrit earlier.
You?
Guy said, why did you just say chocrit? I have no explanation for that.
See, now I'm thinking of it. I know I said it wrong the first time. Now I'm thinking of it.
That's why I had you say it again, because I knew you'd probably fail then, too.
Defibrillators.
Okay, there you go.
There we go. That the people with them, 20% of them, don't meet the evidence-based guidelines for implantation. The study's co-author, Dr. Alan Kadish, who can probably say the word much better than I can, expected the number would be lower.
The defibrillator is a great device for people who need it, but it's expensive and has some risk associated with it, and it shouldn't be put in people who do not.
So let me understand this. If you don't need a thing that zaps your heart with electricity every now and again, you probably shouldn't have it implanted and hooked up to your heart.
Yeah, and they're really expensive. And
you should avoid that.
So
it's like a party prank or something. You shouldn't just do that.
Kadish says the high-tech devices are great for people who need them, but because of the risks involved, they shouldn't be put in people who don't.
Apart from cost, there is a small incidence of death associated with the implantation procedure and a significant incidence of complications that can be associated with defibrillator implantation.
I mean, here's the thing about that. And when he talks about an implanted defibrillator, that's not the same thing as a pacemaker, though, I don't think. I mean, I think they're two different things. Because this sounds like it actually...
Yeah, no, the pacemaker actually, I think...
It regulates
your heartbeat. The defibrillator is something that if your heart skips a beat, it like gives you a little charge. It actually notices if your heart's not beating correctly, and then it gives you a little jolt.
It gives you a little more juice. Like it sort of picks up the tempo a little bit. So that is one of those technologies that seems simultaneously really, really advanced in space age, and then also like incredibly like ham-fisted and barbaric, you know? Where there's just like a huge set of jumper cables that are implanted inside your thorax, and it just goes and just zaps you every. I mean, it's like a shock collar stuck inside your rib cage.
It sounds like one of those things that someday in the future there will be something that will just fix people's hearts, and they'll go, you know, there was a time when we used to put these electronic devices inside people's hearts that would just shock them when they'd start.
Well, you know, I think about that with like nearly every cancer treatment you can think of.
Just used to shoot you through with poison and just hope it would kill all the bad stuff.
I mean, you gotta figure that in like 25 years they're gonna be writing articles about how like, and we used to just like, you know, dose people with radiation until they were nearly dead. Why? To heal them? I mean, it just makes no sense at all. You know, where they would just like, you know, hold on, we just got this big like this bag of weed killer we're gonna hang here and just run it into your veins for a few months. You know, let us know how things work out for you and you and the cancer. Let's do one more here and then we'll take a break.
Two teens were indicted yesterday in North Carolina in the death of their father, whose I can't say anything.
By the way, somebody has noted that your wrestling name needs to be Dawn the Defibrillator Taylor. I'm going to do that for the rest of today, not like forever.
I'm going to take a running start at this one again.
Would you like to just hold on a second? I'm going to give you a little moment here. All right. Can just sort of... All right.
Two teens were indicted yesterday in North Carolina in the death of their father, whose decapitated body was found stuffed in a freezer late last year, months after he was killed. The teen's mother was already charged with murder in the case. We actually did discuss this case many months ago when it first came up. Alexis Morgan Green, 17, and David Reuben Green, the 3rd, 15, were charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder in the death of their father, 52-year-old David Reuben Green Jr. Their mother was charged with first-degree murder. Investigation of the case began in early September when David Green's family members contacted the sheriff's office to report him missing. On September 7th, deputies conducted a search of the couple's Raleigh home, but were unable to locate him. A second search was conducted in October. The home had since been abandoned, and the power inside had been shut off. During a walkthrough of the residence, authorities detected an unusual smell coming from the freezer in the basement. When deputies opened the freezer, they discovered Green's headless body. Wendy Green had been found living in nearby Robeson County. She was arrested and taken into custody. Green died of blunt force trauma, according to an autopsy. According to police, the teenagers gave statements to investigators implicating them as having played active roles in the planning and commission of their father's murder, as well as cleaning up the crime scene in an effort to conceal the crime.
You know, I wonder if that's like a whole where you have to do like a sort of a rock, paper, scissors thing to try to figure out exactly who's going to take what part of that.
You cut the head off. No, you cut the head off. No, I'm the mom and I say you cut the head off.
And also, like, is that – I mean, when you're a cop – you know, because there's a whole thing, you know, most cops will go like their entire career where they never, you know, they never pull out their gun. They never shoot anybody. Most cops never have a car chase, you know, and much less you just go into a guy's house and it's just like, you know, like a headless body in the freezer, you know, or you're going, there's like a pit where he kept cheerleaders for 20 years or something. So when that does happen to you, I wonder if your first thought is just like, what kind of book can I write about this? Because there's that whole, because that true crime niche. Like, you probably went through a phase where you were a true crime reader,
oh, yeah,
where you just consumed, you know, lots of, you know, like Say You Love Satan kind of books.
And Rule and all of that.
Yeah, you know, or it was just, you know, Bloodstained Lies or something. And it's all just, it's, if you ever take a good look at the true crime section of a bookstore, it's like the romance section where there's just thousands of books, many of them, you know, by just the same handful of authors, you know, whether it's like your Anne Rule or but she has some sort of like mainstream, you know, recognition factor that people sort of know who she is. You know, she has some sort of presence in the mainstream consciousness. But you look at any particular niche of the book world and you'll see that there's some author who's got like 97 books in print. And apparently has sold like 40 million copies of, and you've never heard of them. And the true crime wing of the bookstore is always full of these things. And you realize that that is just an audience that cannot get enough of really horrible, perverse stories like this. So you've got to figure if you're a cop and you have anything on the ball at all and you just go into a house and you just, you know, something like that happens, you've got to immediately start thinking about like who it is that you can pitch that idea to.
Or how many free drinks you're going to get at the bar evening when you go out with your cop buddies.
Because there's some sort of a, you know, like, you know, best case of the week,
yeah,
you know.
Or just some sort of, Jimmy opened the freezer with the body. We owe him.
Yeah.
Let's all buy him a couple of rounds.
Seriously, that would make you, for the average person, that would probably make you reconsider your choice of career as a law enforcement agent. Because that's not really the sort of thing that you anticipate happening to you, because how could you?
I have so many questions, though, because obviously there was some thought about what to do, you know, in the case of
right.
this crime. The three of them conspired to kill the dad. And even if it was sort of a crime of passion and it happened spur of the moment, there was some thought afterwards about
right.
cutting off his body and putting him in a freezer. So what happened in that period where they moved away and I guess didn't think through the idea that the power was going to be turned off
right.
when they moved out of the house, but the body was still in the freezer?
Yeah.
Because it was going to be found.
Well, people never really think this through because like we have these stories occasionally where it's like the guy will just he'll kill like, you know, I don't know, he'll kill like a bunch of Cub Scouts and stick them in his basement. And then either he'll just like put them there like under like, you know, he'll like in the dirt floored basement, or he'll put like a really cheap ass layer of concrete over it, which he must know at some point is going to be removed. Because, you know, because it's just a temp job anyway, you know, and it's like if anybody wants to do any remodeling, they're going to find it. Or they're, you know, the guy who will like, we had this story, I don't know, it was a couple of years ago, about the guy had killed somebody and it's like he killed somebody, put him inside like a footlocker and then like welded the footlocker shut. So he had the presence of mind to think, well, I got to hide the body. Presence of mind to think this footlocker is openable. I better do something to make sure it can't be opened. But it never really occurred to him that even if you weld the footlocker, you know, shut, like, it's still just a footlocker. Like, it's basically just made of wood, you know? And also, by the way, if there's a footlocker welded shut that's in the attic and there's blood leaking out of it, that's the sort of thing that people tend to open eventually because they want to figure out what... It's like a horrible box of Cracker Jacks. They just have to know what's inside.
This is one of the things I always have issues with on TV shows. There was something I just watched a week or so ago where a child had gone missing and no one ever found the kid. And then years later... the mom's going crazy and something's going on. I don't even remember the real plot. But anyway, they found the kid stuffed in a footlocker in the attic.
Right.
And everyone had been living in the house. And the kid was now kind of, it had been like 3 years or something. The kid was kind of all dried out and mummified. But the thing is, bodies stink. When dead bodies start to decompose, and that happens fairly quickly, they stink. If you've ever just had chicken go bad in your kitchen and you know what that smells like, dead bodies smell worse. There's a reason when they say, and the police came into the house and they smelled an odd smell coming from the basement. You know what? They were probably upstairs in the living room when they heard that smelled that smell coming from the basement. So it's like, I'm sorry, I don't buy a family living in a house with a body rotting in their attic.
Well, and also, I mean... I guess that maybe you'd have to think through, maybe it doesn't immediately occur to you where to take the body or where to dispose of it, but at some point you gotta take it somewhere. Like you just, that's what I don't get, is the people who just...
Take it off site.
Yeah.
Put it in a dumpster.
They just
something out of your property line.
Right, and they kill somebody and think, well, I don't know, I couldn't think of an absolutely safe place to dispose of it, but it's like... Any place picked at random, any spot on Earth just picked arbitrarily is going to be better than keeping it, you know, in your home, which is the first place. It's not even the first place they're going to look because they're not even looking there. That's just where they're going to come to say, hey, are you Mr. Okay. You know, and then it's like, and then they get to knock off early and go drink it with Jimmy, who found the body without the head. So, I mean, yeah, it's, and I, once again, giving advice to criminals, which is apparently what we do. But it's like the people who are found with the murder weapon, you know, and you say to yourself, the goddamn river is right over there. You know, I think about that all the time. You know, whenever I go over the Hawthorne Bridge, I just think, you know, it's like, how difficult is it, like in Portland, because you'll see these cases where it's like they find the bloody knife like wrapped in a sock in the guy's, you know, in the guy's attic. And you think, well, there, you know, we have a river, or barring a river, like even where I live, there's probably 7 apartment buildings within a square mile of my home. Every one of those apartment buildings has a dumpster out front. Mm-hmm. Every one of those dumpsters is emptied like twice a week. And you know what? Ain't nobody going through dumpsters, Jack, mm-hmm. looking for anything. There's not recycling anything from there. The only people who are recycling things from dumpsters are homeless guys who probably have a lot of motivation to avoid talking to law enforcement. So it's just, you know, it just doesn't seem that hard. Although maybe...
Or you know something? You just clean... It's a knife. You know, you just clean it up real good. You leave it laying around on the street somewhere. Someone's going to pick it up and go, hey, free knife.
I guess.
And it will never be seen again.
Or maybe it's just that thing where, like, maybe it's the thing where, like, once you, maybe it's the thing where, like, you've got the body in your, you know, in your attic. But, like, every time you leave the house, like, there seems to be, you know, like, the gardener's out front or something. Or, like, you know, like, you know, Bobby the Paperboy is coming by and he wants to stop and talk to you about the Packers and what they're going to do this season or something. Maybe it's sort of a comedy of errors, mm-hmm. you know, where they keep taking the body at the front door and it's like that's when, like, you know, the Rotary Club stops by.
But if you have the tools and the wherewithal to take the guy's head off in the first place, chop him up in even smaller pieces, put him in garbage bags and take him out piece by piece.
Take him out Andy Dufresne style.
Yeah.
Just like one cubic inch at a time in your pants.
Yeah.
There you go. See, that's great. And then the pants go last.
And you cut them up in the bathtub because then you can clean out the bathtub with like the bleach and then and it's nice and neat and clean and everything's all tidy.
Hey, here's a question. Do they sell... Well, we really have to break here because poor Jim is sitting in the kitchen. We're busy talking about how to dispose of bodies. That's so much better than talking about clown sex.
Or Jesus.
Do they sell, like, can you buy, just the average person, can you buy luminol? Like, the, like you know, the whole jazz with the light where you shine and you see the blood or the DNA or whatever?
I'm sure you can. There's got to, I mean, it's, well, cause there's not a controlled substance, so I'm sure there's somewhere you can pick that up.
Well, there's, like, certain law enforcement things that, like, you can't buy. Like, you know, like, you can't buy lock picking tools or whatever.
How about there are other substances, though, that would stand in and do a similar thing to luminol if you use them? I'll bet if you went on, you could find some holistic health website or something. What household items are just like, would do the same thing? And there's probably somebody who goes, well, you know, apple cider vinegar will do the same thing, but just not as well, but, you know. or something like
that.
All right,
we should totally continue this conversation when we come back, because that's the thing I want to know. Here's why. Because I want to find some of that, and I want to do the studio.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
No, you don't.
I do. That's the
you
thing.
You really don't.
No, the thing is, I don't want to know, but now I need to know. So, like, that's the thing that I gotta get to the bottom of. We'll come back on the other side of this with Mr. Big Jim Willig, another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Today, talking about the life and career of Mr. Lewis Black. Later on, we'll do the top five. Also, Corpse Watch. Unbelievably, this wasn't the Corpse Watch. I mean, really,
no,
like,
it wasn't.
You know, defying all the laws of probability.
And I have a surprise for you.
Really?
I do.
When do I get that? So in the immediate future? It's not now. It's
no,
later.
As soon as we get back with the gym, I have a surprise for you.
Is it going to make me happy?
Yes.
Is it that story about the pit bulls in New York?
No, it's not a story. It's a thing.
Okay. All right. So that is all on the way. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. The word of the day is defibrillator. Stay right there, won't you please?
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
We'll pick up a pizza, pineapple, ham, and put it in the back of a good times van. We'll go out and pick up the rest of the band. We're gonna have a good time. Yeah, Lily of the Valley, Lily on the rug. Lily drove here in a VW Bug. Am I on the guest list? Give her a shrug. We're gonna have a good time. Yeah, we gonna be like an ice cream cone. You better eat it quick, gonna be long gone. Buy me a whiskey, get yourself stoned. We gonna have a good time. Well, sit on the table, sit on the floor. Act like a virgin, act like a soul. Winner or loser, they'll both do fine. And we're gonna have a good time. Well, I see you in Atlanta or Abilene. Prettiest girls that I've ever seen. Be sweet as honey, girl, don't be mean. And we're gonna have a good time. Yeah, we're gonna be like an ice cream cone. Better eat it quick, gonna be long gone. Buy me a whiskey, get yourself stoned. And we're gonna have a good time. Shut the hell up. Sneak out a beer in a styrofoam cup. I'm gonna start singing, so don't interrupt. And we gonna have a good time. We'll live in the country, live in the town. Come out tonight, gonna burn them all down. Don't let the bachelors get yourself down. And we gonna have a good time. Yeah, we gonna be like an ice cream cone. Better eat it quick, gonna be long gone. Buy me a whiskey, get yourself stoned. We gonna have a good time. I said buy me a whiskey, get yourself stoned. And we gonna have a good time, yeah.
Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. In just a moment, we will be... Were you just talking about sports with Jim Willig?
I was.
Okay.
All right. I was talking about sports in that fashion of going...
What is the deal with...
What's this thing that I don't know anything about since I don't know about sports?
So. Jim Willig will be joining us in just a moment to bring us this week's installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Today talking about the life and career of Mr. Lewis Black. Today's Rick Emerson program. That was a great little cringe you just did there, by the way. That was the whoever used these headphones last is deaf.
It's a silent cringe.
Yeah. Sometimes I will actually come in here at the, you know, like in the morning... at the outset of the show, and I'll plug the headphones in, and I'll go to put them on, you know, and I will have been the one to have used them last, and they will be so loud, and actually, I will just say, but I won't realize right away that I was the one who used them, and I'll be like, God, the poor bastard who used these last, boy, that guy's got no hearing left, I pity him.
Well, it's like, I think Carlin had a bit about, like, you know, you're in the car, you're driving around, you're having a good time, you're cranking your favorite song, and then you get back in the car,
yeah.
And you're just like, you know, who the hell was listening to the radio this loud?
Because suddenly the journey is just blasting out at full volume, and you realize, like, here, I'll realize that over the course of the day, I actually will... From, like, you know, noon when we start Legion of News until the end of the show, I will actually slowly raise the volume level of my headphones over the course of the day, which means that, like, if you were to cut to, like, some sort of a house-style CGI thing of inside my ear, where the cilia are just falling like trees in front of St. Helens, you know? Just, like, the blast radius is, like, the entire inside of my ear canal. So, anyway, what are you going to do? So the Rick Emerson Radio Program brought to you by, among other folks, Squires Electric. Find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com. Or you can call them at 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. And in my day planner, in my at-a-glance planner for 2011, today I have written down one of my action items for today is to contact Joe Squires and try to schedule a time because he wants to come in and sort of hang out, watch us do the show. And then and I'm going to have him prepare a top five and then also talk about the whole nuclear submarine thing. So that is actually on my list of things to do. It's just that never had a good time to do it over the holidays. But Joe Squires has been operating that business for over a decade now. And he's from Portland and the business is based here in Portland, so you can feel good about that, about your money staying in the community. And it's just a great business and a great bunch of guys, and they really are. And we've had listeners that have called them, have used them to come out and to either repair something or to install the wiring system from scratch, or sometimes you get smoke damage or water damage. Sometimes if you get a building that was vacated because there was some sort of an incident there earlier, you want to make sure that the incident does not recur, and they can help you with that by coming out and making sure that everything is working properly. They'll get you an estimate up front so you know about what it's going to cost. 503-252-16 is the number, 503-252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
No one heard that.
What?
What were you going to say, Jim?
I was going to say the quality of the show is paramount to Squires.
That's,
basically.
Well, it's really, I mean, without Squires, there would be, well, literally there would be no wiring, first of all, because they actually, this entire building is wired by Squires Electric.
You'd just be on the roof of the
building. I'd be shouting a lot, really, just screaming. All right, I don't even know what we're doing today. Today is just, here's the thing about today, is that today... Well, I was going to say that nothing has gone wrong, but that's actually not true. The first 12 minutes, I think, of Legion of News were broadcast to, like, it was really what you just said, like, to no one. Because there was some sort of something on the wing of the plane between here and Cascadia. And so the audio was leaving, and then it was just sort of like, it was just going straight out to Jodie Foster's dad, like on Mars. There was just, it was not stopping anywhere on Earth.
Skinny way with, sway in the wind.
So there's just, it's just been one of those. The last couple of days have been a little odd. Not bad as such, just a little off kilter, I would say. So I feel like my internal gyroscope is not tipping over, but is wobbling ever so slightly. It's a little unsteady.
That's Dawn? Okay. I have something that will cheer you up.
Is it bigger than a baby's arm?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Do you want to introduce?
Is it a thing I could ever guess, or
you probably could eventually, but you know.
But what's the point?
Yeah.
All right.
Do you want to try and guess it in five?
Yes, but let me just say, Jim Willig joining us now. You can find out more about him by going to facebook.com/JimWillig. But that's not true. Well, you son of a bitch, that's not true. Because if you do that, you get that guy in Sacramento. Unless you are also like a skinny Asian man, which, like, who knows? I mean, it's a world of possibility. So.
It's like Men in Black. He basically rides me around with a suit, and then he unzips me and goes and actually has...
Okay, look, you bastard. I'm going to go to... A-hole, I'm going to Facebook right now, and yeah. I'm going to type in... Facebook. I'm not going to click on anything. I'm going to type facebook.com/Jim Willie.
I pop up. I'm just not the first. I'm not.
Yeah,
as
no,
important.
I get a different Jim Willie.
Okay, look.
This guy's in Sacramento.
That's exactly what I was saying. It's a guy in California who is demonstrably not you.
It's like Big Love. It's my secret other family.
He likes The Cure and Faith No More.
Clearly my polar opposite. Well, so, okay, you know.
And here's the thing is, that is the address that I've been giving out on the show, like, since the day you started coming on.
Well, I did send him an apology Facebook message and asked to be his friend, you know, saying that, hey, we've got so much in common, let's be friends.
Let's say theoretically.
Sort of band of Jim Willicks.
If in some alternate world where I was hosting a show where I wanted people to be able to find your Facebook page, what address would I give them in that reality?
That's the address that I've always used. I mean, it's my name.
Nobody seems to contact me. It's strange.
Well, they do. I live a quiet life, plotting, scheming.
They do have that thing though, where they had you pick a
vanity URL.
Then.
But that guy obviously beat him to it. Here's how I know that, because there's this other guy I've talked about. There's this guy in Alabama named Rick Emerson. There's actually two of them. There's a guy in Anchorage, Alaska, and a guy in Alabama. The guy in Anchorage is a realtor. The guy in Alabama raises coonhounds. That's his business. It is Rick Emerson's coonhound business. Or like coonhound kennels, I think is what it's called. And he hates me. He hates me. Seriously, because I beat him to all of the I beat him to registering Rick Emerson for everything. And it's like when they did the Facebook thing, you know, and Facebook was like, hey, as of like Friday at midnight, you will be allowed to register, you know, a simplified URL. Because before it was all like numbers. It was like facebook.com/75552, whatever.
Yeah.
And Facebook did that whole thing where they're like, look, you know, starting this Friday at midnight, there's going to be like a land grab, basically, and you'll be able to register just a simplified URL. And so Sarah and I, we weren't like fooling around. Like we set like four different alarm clocks each and like, you know, because it was like important that we each wanted to get our own like whatever. And so it's like at midnight, like, you know, I'm there and I'm typing in like facebook.com/Rick Emerson, register, bam, success. And I swear to God, like 20 minutes later, I get the angriest email from that guy. And he's like, you are not the only Rick Emerson in the world. Everything that says Rick Emerson does not automatically belong to you. You're a dick.
I will bring you down, Rick Emerson.
And so I have registered. And then, by the way, just to be an ass, what I did is so that I got this application for the Mac. And what it does is it has 250 social networking sites built in. It will automatically troll through them all and tell you which ones don't have your username and then just auto-register it.
Aww.
So I just registered Rick Emerson at like things I'll never use. There's like a golfing site somewhere that I was just like, sure, bam.
See, now you're just being cruel.
Well, yes. And
like Lex Luthor cruel. Like, see, I'm doing this for my own sick amusement.
This, by the way, this is DawnTaylor.com. That's the home of Dawn Taylor Associates, an executive search firm that specializes in the placement of financial professionals.
At all levels.
That's virtually indistinguishable from what you
yes.
do, Don.
Seamless.
By the way, a little bit of a counterpoint, you know what that guy has done, though, is that he has registered the rickemerson@gmail.com account and won't give it up. So he's just that's the thing is he's got that and he's just digging in his heels and he just refuses to. No, it's fine. I mean, look,
I gotta give it up to him. It's like I'm gonna take something and I'm gonna keep it for mine.
You know what? All is fair. So that's fine. I don't begrudge that guy, but it's like when he was snarking at me about the Facebook thing, I'm like, it was a public. You know, like it was a public announcement. It wasn't like I did anything underhanded. Like I typed it in and I hit yes. I mean, it wasn't really like I.
After setting your alarm so that you got up at midnight, so at 12:01,
yes.
Chuckling to yourself and wringing your fingers.
Well, just because he, it's not my fault. He's out slapping the hounds or something. He can't be bothered to go click a mouse. I mean, you know, whatever. So, in any event. Speaking of which, it's time for me to – I got to check that application again and make sure there haven't been any new sites unveiled that I need to register at. We are knee-deep in the Rick Emerson radio program. It is Friday. Oh, I'm supposed to be guessing something.
You are.
Is it a food?
It is.
Are they cookies?
No.
Did you make them?
Yes.
Is it an article of clothing?
It
No.
Okay, welcome to 10 seconds ago when I asked, is it a food?
you can eat clothes.
I suppose. let's see.
It's a cake shirt.
It's a you bacon sweater. Which is delicious, yet at the same time warm and comforting.
I made you waffle pants.
Processed meat socks, now available at rickemerson.org.edu.
Oh, God.
I don't know why that's so funny. I think it was like the... I think it was like the three in a row that were really great. It was cake pants, bacon sweater, meat socks. Was that the last waffle socks? Something.
Meat socks.
God damn. Oh, okay.
You mean an entire ensemble?
I'm so glad it's Friday.
Yeah.
Well, f this. I'm never gonna guess.
Okay.
What have you brought me?
Hi, babe.
It's a large bag of are they brownies?
They're brownies in my
brownie pan that Seamus gave us.
All edges brownie pan.
Ooh. What kind of brownies?
Cream cheese brownies.
Wow. I don't think I've ever had cream cheese brownies. Like a marbled sort of a thing?
Yeah, it's like a little bit of cheesecake on top of a brownie.
I have never had those.
By the way, the baker's edge pan came with its own specially sized.
How great is that? The little spatula thing?
Spatula.
Yeah,
so
this.
You can get the brownies out.
So our friend Seamus for Christmas actually got us, Don and I each received an all edges brownie pan from Seamus.
Very nice.
Because I've lost it after it for a couple years and it's always sold out. And milk. You really do know the way to my heart.
Raise?
Well, because I'm always lamenting the fact that if there's cookie type foods that I can't.
Here,
I'm
the big one, Derek.
I'm all OCD about where I've got to have. Thank you. I've got to have milk or I can't. I'm like the guy in the commercial where it's like if I don't have milk, I can't eat the whatever. So
have I told you how much I resent your properly working metabolism? Have I told you that? Because I see what you eat. I see what you eat. I see the arugula. I see the brownies. All of this.
Yeah.
And nothing. Not an ounce. Because it's not like you're on like a Stairmaster or an elliptical machine like prior to going on the air. No. You're a lazy slob, much like myself, sitting in a chair.
Well, the calories.
Living on snack foods.
Yeah, really. Like, I got to eat a green thing at least once a week to maintain some semblance of non-diabetic lifestyle.
The calories that I expend overcoming my gag reflex later really are, I burn off a lot of weight.
Jim, would you like some milk?
I would love some milk.
Navigating past the uvula really is a lot of exercise for me. Can I just tell you this? You know, it's funny that you mentioned that.
Thank you very much.
And by funny, I mean eventually angering, because I'd actually written down here. We ran late at the beginning of today's show because I swear to God we were talking about the nature of Jesus and the evolution of world religions. But one of the things I had noted is that Dawn mentioned that she had brought something for me, and I think maybe you said this off the air, but you said that you had like a sort of snack. You were making snacks or you were cooking last night, and I guess you were referring to this. And I was going to note that it's this sort of – like I'm in this horrible nexus of fat right now because it's – we've got on the one hand – you've brought these brownies, which I didn't even know, and then – EH Vending is one of our sponsors. They are doing. When you were here last week, we had not yet unveiled Name That Snack, which is our new contest. But they have brought us, and this is not even.
God.
We thought these were the giveaway items, and they're not. This is just like for us. It is like a pallet of snack foods.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Anyway, I asked Joshua, I'm like, so are we supposed to parcel this out and figure out how to apportion? And he's like, oh no. He's like, we'll do the prize baskets. That's just for you two. So, I mean, and it's like. I can't even imagine the number of calories in this box. So then you've got that and the brownies. And then here's the other thing is that so that Laura is gone. She's out of town right now. And so it's like I'm such a – I really do have – like I am really, really lucky I think that my brain knows something I don't know because – you know, we've talked before about how, you know, Don and I are really sort of the yin and yang in terms of history with substance use or abuse. Because Don has a great deal of experience injecting or snorting various things into her body.
Never injecting.
Snorting, smoking.
Everything else pretty much, yes. But,
you know, perhaps inserting, you know, at various times in her life. Whereas I am just really, I mean, I've kind of abused caffeine and that's about it. I mean, I'm sort of relentlessly boring in the you know, the drugs and alcohol sense.
Really?
I'm hopelessly lame in that way.
It was like a summer of pot or, you know.
No, I think, and it's not like. And again, I'm not. It's not like I'm, you know, not like I'm some straight edge guy about it or whatever. And I, you know, it's not like a religious. And I'm not. And the other thing, and the reason I don't really talk about, like, for a long time, I didn't tell people that I didn't drink. And I would actually, like, it, you know, if I was out or if, like, it was like a listener event or something, I would just not mention, or I would just, you know, like, Sarah actually would do the cutest thing. She would actually hand me a beer. And I was basically just holding her second beer all the time because she would swap it out later.
You were beer cozy.
But I would kind of hold a beer the way that women would put on a fake wedding ring. And it was because otherwise I'm not complaining, but the guys were always like, hey, can I get you a beer? And it was like, and then I would have to decline. Then I felt like I looked rude. But then people always assume that you are either like a Jesus freak or that you are a 12-stepper, that you're in recovery. And in that neither of those is the case. I just, you know, it's just not a thing I do.
Of the two, you'd want to be like a 12-stepper. Like there was like some awesome story that you can't go into.
Then you're interesting in the past at least. Yeah. As opposed to being, you know, if you're all like just religious, then you're just lame.
you just say very intently, oh, you don't want to be around me when I drink.
There was an incident. I managed to be lame, like, without the Jesus thing. So what was my point? But I guess I'm sort of lucky that I am that way because – so Lara's gone last night, today. Well, she's basically gone until Tuesday. I mean, that's the thing. Is like she's gone starting last night all the way until next Tuesday. I left here yesterday. I didn't even go home to feed the dog first. It's like on the way home, I just stopped by the supermarket, and I immediately and it's like I'm like what's his name? I'm like Flounder in Animal House, just going through the Food King, you know, with Tom Hulce, and just loading up my sweater, you know. And it's like, and the thing is, and it, I'm such a freak, and just such a simultaneously takes so little care of my body in some ways, and yet I'm so ritualistic about the way I abuse my body because it's like. Because I've got the same path that I take through the supermarket every time. I walk into the supermarket and it's like immediately I hit, you know, I go to the Triscuit aisle. And then the Triscuit aisle is, of course, right next to the spray cheese. And then the spray cheese inexorably it leads me to the breakfast cereal aisle. And then after the breakfast cereal aisle, then I stop by, you know, the dairy department to make sure that I've got adequate milk. And then I've got to get Pop-Tarts, you know, and it's like, you know, and it's basically
family circus like map. Where's Rick been?
Exactly. And so if you were to look at my house right now, I'm
apparently avoiding the produce department.
Oh, completely. Where's I have no idea.
And it's just a wasteland. So it's like I am in some Bermuda Triangle, of poor eating right now, where there's no safe place for me right now. Not home, not the studio. Sponsors fattening me up like I'm the Christmas goose. I mean, anyway.
Well, the thing is, Rick and I talked about this pan.
They sell them at
Think Geek and stuff. And it's so that every single brownie has at least two edges. So it's designed in such a way that every single brownie, because, you know, there are people who like the edge.
God bless evolution.
And this was the first thing I baked in this pan. And this thing is like some serious hardcore heavy gauge aluminum. I mean, wait, feel this.
It's like adamantium.
The pan itself weighs a lot.
Yeah, but that also means though that it conducts heat really, really well. It's
nice, even.
Yeah, this did a fine job. This really, really did. They're a little on the thin side because, you know, of the way the pan kind of tubes everything around. But I cooked them. It said in the instructions to like cook them a little bit less than the recipe normally calls for and to check them every few minutes. And I checked and I look and they're perfect. This pan is awesome.
Is it already devolved into one of those shows where we're just eating? Is this whole milk?
It is.
Good for you. Well done.
I started to get the 2% and I thought, you know, we're eating cream cheese brownies.
Seriously, what the hell? No, see, that is another thing. And in this, you know, sometimes, you know, and Jim, you have a lady friend, Malia, who, you know,
I ordered from a catalog.
And so I, you know, I don't know. I would imagine that, like a lot of guys, you have come to realize that there are certain things, certain behaviors where it's like you just, like, you rely on another person to sort of keep you on the straight and narrow a little bit in terms of things, like whether it's health or whether it's, you know,
oh,
whatever.
Yeah.
But this is one of those things where I do start to sound like every like suburban husband about, you know, like the thing that I can only do when the wife is out of town, because the one fight that I just chose not to have is about milk, because left to my own devices, I would drink whole milk all the time. And she's very much like on the whole like skim milk thing, which I just
there's no point to it. It's vile.
Yeah. And
skim milk is just vile.
And so we compromise sometimes at the 2%, but it's like, you know,
skim milk always smells like it's gone bad already.
Yeah.
Even if it's fresh, you pop it open and you're just like, it's an odd color. It just doesn't, I mean, and the name alone, skim milk. What about those two words together just doesn't sound appetizing?
Yeah, and it's like, and it's the thing where it's like, and I choose not to fight about it because I know that like she comes from a family of, poor eaters. Let's put it that way, where it's like her family, if there was a wrong decision to be made in what you should put in your body in terms of food, it's like they would make it. And so she is sort of, as she's gotten older, she's gone to the other side and she's really become hyper aware of what she eats. So I don't want to F with that. So I just sort of, I kind of grin and bear it. But then whenever she's out of town, I immediately go for the whole milk, like at the, you know, at the store. So well done.
I always used to just buy the 2%, and then I realized at some point I try to avoid drinking milk as much as I can because it's loaded with sugar. And the last time that I actually lost a substantial amount of weight and felt really healthy was when I went on a low carbohydrate diet, and I cut milk out of my diet pretty much entirely. But I still use like heavy cream or half and half and use it in my coffee. And so, but Patrick likes to eat cereal. Patrick loves to drink milk. And so I just realized, you know, what is the point in getting the 2% or the skim milk?
Right.
He's going to be the one drinking it. He's the one putting it on cereal. And if I use it at all, I use it to put in my coffee. Skim milk is useless in your coffee. It just turns it gray and it's disgusting.
And if you're willing to put half and half in your coffee, why not put whole milk in? There's no difference.
Yeah, so we just started buying whole milk and everybody's happier.
Yeah, and no, it really is. And I can't figure out whether I ate well as a kid or whether I ate poorly. It's some weird confluence of the two because it was all, you know, my mom was very into home cooking. Like, she didn't buy, she was very into, like, making our own bread and making our own desserts and our own, you know, whatever. And she resisted anything that was like overly processed
it's the process that makes it good.
Well, it was all staples, but it was all like, but it was all those staples that seem like they're good and then also terrible for you at the same time, where every meal was just like a huge slab of meat. And like 10 potatoes, you know, and like 5 huge slices of bread with real butter on them, and then a giant glass of whole milk, and then a huge wedge of pie. And I would say, is this meal healthy for me or not? Because I can't figure it out.
Is she from the Midwest or possibly the East Coast?
Yes. Well, her family is from the South, and then she also kind of grew up without a lot of money. And so it was just basically staples was all they ate as a kid. Yeah, but so it's like that thing where you're looking at that meal and you're going, well, it seems healthy, but it also seems like the worst possible thing I could eat, you know? Like, eggs are that way. I can never quite figure out whether they're good for me or not.
Well, East Coast has some unique foods that I'm thankful have not made it to the other side of the country. Stuff like Scrapple.
Scrapple.
Which is basically like, you know, compressed meat that you fry and then serve with syrup.
It's like head cheese, right? Where it's just bits and pieces that have been all fried up.
I always imagine it's like that horrible corned beef in a can. Is it kind of like that?
No, it comes out almost like a spam-like consistency, but then it's fried and it has like a crunchy exterior. And then for some mysterious reason, people put syrup on it.
But, like, but it's not
meat
like
and syrup doesn't deserve to go together.
It's not like leavings, though, is it? Is it?
It is. It is like it's basically like the trap that catches all the Scrapple stuff. There's one below it. That
it's the rail at the bar.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, you just tip it into a glass.
It's all snouts and hooves and lips.
Yeah. Pureed,
but with
wadded,
syrup.
And then, yeah.
I didn't know that. I've heard people, I have a friend of mine who's from Lancaster, and she talked about Scrapple, but she never mentioned the syrup thing.
Yeah, I don't know. It just, every time it was served to me, there was always like a thing of syrup. And what confused me, though, was every time I see the container of syrup, I would think, are we having waffles or pancakes also? And I'm just, no, it's for your Scrapple. I'm like, it's like a meat coaster. I want to put like real food on it. I don't want to eat it myself.
Meat coaster. Yeah. Can I just tell you that every other email I'm getting now is about waffle pants?
Yes!
It's been determined that that's the best phrase ever uttered, by the way. So Scrapple sounds like some horrible, like that would be the common term for some skin disease you would get. You know, like others.
Hear about Bill, yeah, he's got the Scrapple.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of like the clap, you know, where it's like, it's just, which is what? That is syphilis?
Gonorrhea.
Gonorrhea. You know, but it's like Scrapple just sounds like, and it gives you like a real sort of chafing, kind of a flaking sort of, you know, on your epidermis.
Scrapple and you, a cautionary tale.
God damn.
It's a common term for psoriasis would be Scrapple.
Exactly. Or
actually the flakes that come off of you when you have psoriasis are the Scrapple.
Or it would be one of those. It would be one of those completely unhealthy products that they market as like a healthy snack to children, where they'd taken like an apple, you know, when they'd removed everything good and then just filled it full of like, you know, full of jam and nails, and then, you know, it's a Scrapple, kid, and it would be like a candied sort of a fruit that they would give you.
We went from the delicious brownies to talking about horrible things. By the way, before I get the emails and the text messages and the Facebooks, if you would like to have the same delicious brownies that we are enjoying here in the Rick Emerson studio, go to the author David Leibovitz's website, Leibovitz. David Leibovitz is a cookbook author, and he lives in France. He has an awesome blog, food blog, and just look for his recipe for, he calls them cheesecake brownies, and that's Ooh. The recipe for the brownies we're eating today, which is a chocolate brownie with chocolate chips in it and a little cheesecake mixture swirled in on the top.
Yeah, they really are quite good. They are really, really something, especially with this. I'm going to be taking one or two of those maybe home with me. For later. And it's like, and, you know, and here's just as a final note, this is really what I'm like without someone around just to polish me up for the public. So I'm standing in the kitchen this morning, you know, because, you know, so it is, you know, Lara's gone and she took Philo. So she's on a trip and she has Philo with her. So I got one dog right now. She's got one dog with her.
You have the angry dog.
I have the angry gluttonous Hitler dog. And so I get up this morning and I'm just – and literally – and I've mentioned before that it's like, you know, my kitchen is adjacent to the bathroom, and so you can see both from the street. So from the street, you can see directly into my kitchen and then straight through to the bathroom. And I was not in the bathroom, fortunately, but this morning I'm just standing – this is me. This is what a class act. I'm standing in the kitchen in my ladybug boxer shorts, nothing else, and just idly scratching myself – picking and with a box of Triscuits in my hand that is nearly empty, and so I'm just doing that thing of like picking it up and tipping it back and then just like dumping the crumbs into my mouth while the dog, you know, like eats, you know, and so the dog and I are basically having the same style of breakfast, you know.
The dog's
looking
at you like, come on, man, get it together.
I'm just, you know, and then that's you know, it's just one of those where you have that that moment of clarity where you stop and you step back and you go, God, I'm a waste.
I mean it's honest, without a woman in your life, men, I honestly believe, would just eat saber-toothed tiger meat, and that would be all. Like, we would just eat meat until we would explode or just become gelatinous and then hunted by other men that were also still hungry and yet still fit enough to drag you back to their cave.
Oh, yeah. Patrick was in his mid-30s when we met, and he literally, I think, could cook, like, two things. He lived on, like fried chicken from Safeway or Albertsons, and he could like cook a steak in a pan. Men, that was pretty much it.
Men can't really cook; they can only thaw. That's kind of the extent of it.
I had one of my exes that I cooked for the very first time. I made her spaghetti, but I wanted to add a little element that was a little unexpected, a little oomph. So I went to the store. I'm trying to find something to add to it, and I settled on those pepperoni meat sticks, and I kind of sliced up into little bitty bits.
It's like sausage.
And I kind of thought that's really what it was, not realizing that it has the consistency of, like, you know, leather. And I threw it in there, and she's like eating. She's like, "This is really okay. What was that?"
Yeah, fantastic.
Just like stop meal dead in its drag. It was horrifying.
And it just like never occurred to you not to do it.
No,
right?
No, of course not. I'm just like, you know, it's meat. It's a meat sauce. You know, the two got to mingle. I mean, they're from the same class.
It all goes together.
One thing though, if I was a mother of a young gentleman, though, one thing I would teach him would be to learn to cook a couple of simple but impressive dishes, because that goes so far with women.
Oh, yeah.
I was, I think, 19 when I was invited to a gentleman's apartment. He was a few years older than me, so he's probably in his mid to late 20s, invited me to his apartment, and he made fettuccine Alfredo, which is about the easiest thing you can possibly make. You boil some some spaghetti. Then you, like, you know, cook, you mix butter and cream and cheese in a pan and you pour it on. But the thing is, he cooked for me and he made fettuccine Alfredo, and he totally got laid. He so got laid.
Well, because it's the veneer of sophistication, and if it's like a first date, or if you're not, you know, if you have just met him or something, or if it's the first time you've had a serious, you know, evening together, you're not going to get a chance to look beyond that. You know what I mean? You're not going to look around the side of the building and realize that it's just that Blazing Saddles town or something. It's enough to carry him through.
Yeah.
The veneer of sophistication can get guys. We got to get to some stuff here. We got to do Humor Me. We got to do the top five. We got to do either the Corpse Watch or the Nazi Watch. Okay. One of the two. But the veneer of sophistication can carry guys through just, you know, any number of. Of first dates, but then the thing is, you either got to add to your repertoire, or you just got to, like, you know, or you just got to, like, you got to move on to somebody else, you know, like immediately, because then if the girl comes back for a second or third date and she realizes that there is no other meal you can cook, then it all just falls apart. But I've talked about the at one point I learned to operate a Zippo lighter one handed, even though I don't smoke, because one time in my life I did actually in fact have the opportunity. You know, she was like fumbling for it was the whole thing where she's like fumbling for the matches, and it's like suddenly there's Rick Emerson, whoosh, you know, with the one-handed Zippo open, you know, and
I have no idea why that is sexy, but it is.
But it totally is. And as I mentioned, it was the Sin City lighter that had this sort of like this sort of like hourglass dame or whatever on the side of it, and it was just fantastic. The one other thing I should I'll give this guys, here's a little bit of advice from this is a thing I'm no longer using this, so this is I'll give it away so you can use this in your own life. This is when I lived in Salt Lake. There was a girl that I was taking. We were going out, and we were going to go to dinner somewhere. And I think it was our first date or whatever. I forget where we even met, but it's like we hadn't ever really gone anywhere or done anything. But I was taking this girl on the first date, and we were going to this restaurant. It was like an Italian place. And so the deal is, the date was at like 8 o'clock. Like that's when we were going to dinner. So I just swung by at around 6 o'clock. And I had sort of looked over the menu, and I kind of estimated what the dinner was going to cost. I figured, you know, like, okay, if she orders this, I order this. She gets a drink, you know, drinks, and we get, you know, she gets dessert and whatever, and there's the tip. And so I kind of estimated what the dinner was going to cost, and then I added a little bit onto that, and then I just paid it in advance. I just gave the guy, you know, like I figured it was like $50 or whatever, so I gave them like $75. And I'm like, I talked to the manager and I worked this whole thing out. And so then we go to dinner later that night. And, you know, we're there and, you know, we're having dinner and it's a great old time or whatever. And then the guy comes over to bring us the check. And then the manager, of course, at that point comes over and he steps and he blocks the waiter and he goes, no, Mr. Emerson eats free here. And then he.
Oh, that is pimp.
And it was like, and the deal was like, he just pocketed the overage because the mission had been accomplished. And so, and I was just, oh, really? Oh,
your buddy's so good here, sir.
Yeah, and it was like Mr. Emerson's not to be charged. And I was like, oh, you should really,
Giuseppe, come on.
You sure I can't just give you a little? Okay, all right. Well, the next time, though, I mean, you know, okay, because I can't. All right, but thank
that
you.
Would feel
no,
bad.
Really, I appreciate it, but that it means not.
It's a Tony Soprano move,
you know. And here's the brilliant thing about that, if I may say so myself, is that I came up with that all on my own. I didn't even like. It's not even like I copped that from like a Vince Vaughn movie or something like that. Is just, and so of course, then the guy leaves the table. And then the girl looks at me, and I just did that whole like, it happens sometimes. I try to be humble about it. I'm just a person, really. Shall we leave? You know, it was, yeah.
And?
Just created a new segment. Rick Emerson helps you get laid.
Yeah, but the thing is that's the one arrow in the quiver there. After that, I've got nothing. We should probably go right to gym segment because I want to make sure Greg and Sarah are going to be here, and I know they've got a guest coming in today, so we should make sure that we don't get too overtime. So we will probably end up bumping the top five.
Yeah, and everything I've got can wait until Monday if need be.
Well, there's brownies to eat too, so we've always got that to occupy. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Mr. Big Jim Willig here with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101.
Thank you very much, Rick Emerson. Well, stand-up comedy is filled with frustrations. Long hours on the road, culminating in tiny rooms filled with drunken, humorless townies, and a lonely hotel room as your only constant companion. It's enough to drive some comics mad. But the
fine line that separates genius and madness leads right to the stage. And for my money, the lunatic that I want standing on that stage is Louis Black. His rage is like a finely sharpened Wolverine that he hurdles at an imperfect world. Mr. Black has taken the medium of observational humor and elevated it to such a degree that the viewer is left to ponder if, in fact, Louis is the crazy one, or if he's the last sane man in a world without reason. And with that, I turn things over to the two people sharing the studio with me at this time, Mr. Rick Emerson and Miss Dawn Taylor. Your thoughts on Louis Black?
Louis Black is, here's the great thing about him, is that he simultaneously seems, he seems from a different era. Like, he does seem like a man sort of not of his time, not, you know, but then I can't really think of what era he seems like he is from. He just seems like a, the great thing about Louis Black and the reason his act plays so well, because it is, it's not a shtick. I don't want to say that it's a shtick, but he has a persona.
Yeah.
And it's not even that he's playing a character. There's a sort of a difference there. You know, there's some comics get up. Bob Goldthwait played Bobcat Goldthwait. And, yeah. I forget his real name now, but what's-his-name played Andrew Dice Clay, who was sort of a—his name is like Andrew Silverstein or something. And it's like he played Andrew Dice Clay, was this sort of character, as opposed to a persona, which is sort of one aspect of your real personality that is sort of put front and center. Sam Kinison had a persona. Carlin had a persona. And Louis Black does as well. But the persona is sort of the last sane man who is just teetering on the brink of a full-on mental breakdown because he is confronted by lunacy in the world around him, and he doesn't, and it is the guy who doesn't, he is always one step out of sync with the rest of the world, and he's the only one who notices it. And to me, it's always had a very not quite born at the right time feel to it, which is what makes him, which is what makes that work so well. It is that he just, his whole, the whole feel of Louis Black's comedy is that it's a guy who just was born into a world that is not quite in sync with the way he thinks it ought to be, and over time it has grown into a series of massive, completely disproportionate frustrations.
For me, Louis has always been like he is my frustration. You know, embodied. He's what I want my frustration to be like. Intelligent, articulate, but at the same time, just at that point where he's one step away from just taking a wild, you know, haymaker swing at a world that he sees as being as broken as it is. He, in my mind, kind of harkens to like Roddy Piper in They Live. Like, he's got the sunglasses. He can see all the cracks, all the imperfect aspects to this world around him. Nobody else really kind of sees it. They kind of sort of feel that there's something amiss, but he sees it all. And that rage, to the point where he can't even hold a finger straight. It's just like, oh!
Louis Black has seemed to me, and I'm not saying that this is how he, where he got it from, but if you remember the way that Belushi used to be on the Weekend Update sometimes, where Belushi would do the, you know, the sort of, you know, the, but no, you know, but my cousin, who I had to bail out of jail. And it's like, and Belushi had that thing where, and his, I think his stock ending to that character was Belushi would get so amped up that he would eventually start twitching, and he would literally like hurl himself off the stage. He would fling himself off camera. He would go out of the shot. And Black has a thing that's, and here's a thing I didn't know, because I knew you were going to talk about Louis Black today, and so I was actually just kind of looking him up online. I didn't know he was 62.
Yeah.
And that, I think, gives him, that is where some of that man not quite of his time stuff comes from, because he doesn't really seem like a 62-year-old the same way that Carlin never seemed like a guy who was in his 70s. I mean, he seems crotchety or cranky in that way, but he also is just like so sharp and so just, you know, everything is just to an absolute diamond point with his wit and with the way that he constructs his sentences. And, you know, and he defies the whole mellowing with age thing, too, that happens with a lot of comics.
He worked for the Appalachian Regional Commission under Richard Nixon. Which I'm not even 100% sure what the Appalachian Regional Commissioner does. But, I mean, he's always had a very firm grasp in politics and everything else. But you see him do stand-up. I mean, he'll go off on, you know, bottled water. All the staples that comics go off on. He isn't just specifically a politically oriented comedian. He has his, like you said, his diamond point in all directions.
And, you know, he also has that thing where the really profane meets the really smart, which is hard to do well, because that's a mixture that is people often do the wrong proportions of that, where they will try to be, you know, the people will say, well, he's, you know, like the Judd Apatow model, where it's the smart filtered through dumb or dumb filtered through smart. And that's the thing where, the combination, you know, and the ratio of profane to intellectual is never this, you know, it sort of shifts and it goes back and forth depending on what the subject is. And you really have to have just an intuitive sense of how much you can use of each at any given moment. And he's a guy that really does excel at that. And he had a bunch of, and I mean, you know, everybody knows him for The Daily Show, but he's also done several Broadway shows, hasn't he? Hasn't he done?
He did a stand-up show on Broadway, like some
there was Black on Broadway, too. And then there was something else. He did one other Broadway show, I think, and maybe he is preparing a third, but he's amazingly prolific.
Well, he did that one in Washington, D.C.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of, one at the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that I'm thinking of, I guess. But he's got, like, I don't know, he's got, like, 9 comedy albums or something out.
And about that, and he's also got about 3 books out. My suggestion, if you ever want to get a real good grip on Lewis Black, pick up the White Album, because that was really the first full album that I listened to of Lewis's. And that's got some of his classic bits. One of them, my personal favorite, he talks about sitting at an IHOP and overhearing a woman in the booth behind him use the sentence, "Well, if it wasn't for that horse, I wouldn't have spent that year in college." And how his brain is trying desperately to figure it out.
The context.
Yeah.
Let's see. I've got a little bit of audio here. So this is, I think this is from The Daily Show. So this is... this is Lewis Black talking about George W. Bush.
And for you Republicans who still just think, wow, Lou, you're so wrong. I can't believe you can't see what this man is doing. I got something else. If this doesn't get through to you, then, whoa, you might need to be electroshocked. He left on Christmas Eve. He was on his Christmas vacation, and he headed to the Brooke Army Medical Center, which is in San Antonio, where he was visiting troops who'd returned from Afghanistan and who were mostly amputees. And he said to them, as you can possibly see, I have an injury myself. If you have an asthma inhaler, you might want to get it out now. I didn't have it here at the hospital, but in combat with a cedar. That's a tree. He was fighting a tree. I eventually won. Our president beat the tree.
And it's that thing of the sense you get from him, and again, is that does nobody else see like what a lunatic bin this whole place is? It is.
Well, the quote is that he said he's described his humor as being on the Titanic every single day and being the only person who knows what's going to happen.
Right, right.
The Groundhog Day on the Titanic.
I was just going to say he's almost like a much more he's like an externalization of the. Of that low simmer anger that Bill Murray does in his best roles, yeah. Where Bill Murray is the lone intelligent man in the middle of this maelstrom of morons, mm-hmm. And where everybody around him is on the same moronic level, and so by definition they cannot see the idiocy, and he just and Murray does it where he becomes the more insane things become, the more laconic he is in response to that. Whereas Lewis Black does, as you said, the escalating toward the eventual volcanic breakdown.
Yeah, because you can't just be that angry, that over the top all the time and still have any kind of staying power. It becomes, like you said, it becomes a shtick. His persona is one where, as you heard in that last bit, he can start off quiet and like patient as if he's talking to an idiot child. And at the same time, he's slowly building and building and building. And then when he erupts, it is like Krakatoa.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
No, he knows how to modulate it. This is, let's see, this is another one. I think this is him on The Daily Show, I believe, talking about video games.
Reality. If you're like me, you spend every waking moment trying to escape from it. And recently, I've discovered something that's better than reality. Video games. Okay, so I'm 25 years too late. at least according to my calculator watch. Look at this thing. It's a watch and it's a calculator. This is amazing. PlayStation 2 has made tremendous progress in digitizing my fantasy life. For example, here's Britney Spears' dance beat, in which you audition to be one of Britney Spears' backup dancers.
Come on now.
That's right. The best you can do is become a backup dancer. It's the perfect game for people who disappoint themselves even in their fantasies. Now, even though dance is my first love, I was looking for a game with a little more panache. And by panache, I mean this. This game is called State of Emergency. Its high-minded premise puts you to work taking down a fascist multinational corporation that controls the country. And how do you do it? By walking into a shopping mall and shooting anything that moves. You see, one person can make a difference. And nothing sticks it to the man like taking out a Cinnabon. Now, if senseless bloodshed in the name of anti-corporate activism seems a little too goody-goody for you, then how about senseless bloodshed in a moral vacuum? This is Grand Theft Auto 3. The object of this game... Who cares? I'm too busy randomly hitting an old lady with a bat, carjacking a station wagon, and running over people. Or my personal favorite, running over the person whose car I just stole with the car I just stole.
See, this, and it's like that, and it's the like the really like gleeful, this music has never sounded like more of a train wreck segue. But it's just, it's that like really gleeful buzzsaw edge to his voice, which I think in lesser hands would become really monotonous too. And I think it would just, it would seem more like a shtick than it does. And it's to his credit that it still sounds fresh every time he does it.
By the way, I there's something came up on Wikipedia that I didn't remember. I didn't ever even really knew this happened. Apparently his first comedy special was in 1998. So it's not like he's been, you know, in the public eye for right. a terribly long time. In 2000, he and comedian Jim Norton were arrested for doing something called the Naked Teen Voyeur Bus.
The Opie and Anthony show.
Yeah, it was a specially designed bus with acrylic glass sides that had 18 and 19-year-old girls naked in the bus. And it cruised around Manhattan while they were broadcasting on the Opie and Anthony show. This is unfortunately, no one informed the Opie and Anthony show, though, that Norton and Black's bus was taking the same route that President Clinton was taking that day. So they were arrested. 28 hours later after the arrest, they were released. He appeared on The Daily Show the following night where he talked about it and said he was exercising his constitutional rights. He then said the location of this particular right was unclear, but it's somewhere between all men are created equal and don't S where you eat.
I had forgotten about that because Norton, who I think is like sort of one of the in-house comedians at that show, it was sort of notorious for, you know, for doing things like that. I had forgotten, though, I knew that he had been arrested because it then, I think it actually prevented him. There was something he was engaged to do. There was something he was supposed to do. He was going
to
perform
somewhere. He was supposed to be at a fundraiser for New York Attorney General candidate Mark Green.
Yeah, and he wasn't able to do it because of the arrest. But I had forgotten that Lewis Black had been part of that. And so he really did come. So The Daily Show was kind of his... was really his breakthrough, which came late in life. And I always root for guys like that too. That, I mean, he did stuff. He was obviously, you know, successful, and he was a playwright, and I know he did a lot of, you know, he did a lot of theater work and stuff. But as far as mainstream success goes, that really came with The Daily Show, I think, and, you know, in terms of being a household name to a lot of people. And I love guys who do that relatively late in their careers. I always think it's cool when a guy who's like 50 or something, you know, finally sort of launches into stardom like that.
Actually, I didn't realize this until I started doing a little bit of background on Lewis, but the Back in Black segment has been around on The Daily Show since the days of Craig Kilborn.
Really?
Yeah, because there's a couple of YouTube clips that I clicked on, and there's Craig, and it's his exact same intro. He's like, whenever there's a news story that falls through the cracks, you know, blah, 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 blah. But, yeah, Lewis Black's, he had a brother that died of cancer, I think, at the age of 47. And really, at that point, was when Lewis kind of got the fire kind of lit underneath him to really kind of continue pushing even harder to get that breakthrough moment. And so to this day, he still kind of considers his brother as like an archangel in that capacity.
That's, you know, I like guys, too, that have, you know, again, the thing that is tricky to do without it losing its punch over time, but who have a great stock open and a stock close to their bits. And there's that great thing he does on The Daily Show where he will just work himself into just some apoplectic rage. And then he'll finally just throw it at his script and go, John! And then, like, that's the end of it. And it's just, it's fantastic. I don't know why. It just kills me every time I see him do that. Because I think he opens with that, too. I think that's how he starts the rant. And then it ends with the same thing. So, again, he's got, so I guess he's got a new a book that is coming out. Or he's got a new, I think he's got something that just came out. It's called, it's like Black from the Beginning or something. I think he's got sort of an autobiography that's just been released. Because the book he put out, and again, he's one of those guys, too, where you just realize you realize he's just done so many things. And you ask yourself, like, when does he have time? I think about guys who write a lot of books, especially, because that is a thing that, you know, if a guy's doing like a lot of, you know, releasing a lot of CDs or a lot of DVDs, you know, of his act, that in a way I think is easier because you're killing two birds with one stone, quite literally, where you're doing the stand-up tour and then all along the way there's a guy filming it or recording it and then they put it out as a DVD. Yeah. You know, the book, unless it's a transcription of your act, is a wholly separate thing that requires time where you, by definition, can't be doing anything else. It's not like you can be writing while you're playing a video game or something. And so when a guy writes a lot of books like this, I always just wonder, like, do guys like Lewis Black just not sleep? I mean, do they, you know?
Well, it's like when you're a band, they say you have your entire life to write your first album.
Right.
You've got 6 months to write your second one. You know, same is true in comedy. The only difference is with Lewis Black, because he didn't hit until he was close to 50. Yeah, he had his entire life to write his first album, but he also had enough material left over for a second and a third and a fourth.
No, that makes
sense.
So
by the time, you know, he got around to finally getting that push, he can finally, you know, he had more than enough jokes in the stable to sort of just keep cranking them out.
And probably if you don't start to get your mainstream success until you are like 45 or 50, you probably, the good thing about that is you got a lot of material built up because you just haven't been doing it. You said his first stand-up special was like 1998, so I mean, yeah, he would have been 50 because he was born in 48. Also, if you're still in show business at 50, there's a couple of things, you know. One is that's not, you know, that it's a business you really truly love, and it's a thing that you just feel you have to do, that it's a calling, because nobody stays in that. There's, you know, the money is so uncertain and there's so many other things that are unstable about it, that if you're still in show business at 50 and you haven't really broken through in a mainstream way, you're doing it because you like it. So that bodes well for your career. And also, if you're still in show business when you're 50, you have learned to harness whatever self-destructive habits might come along with that. And you've also learned to make the most of the opportunities when they arrive, or you wouldn't still be in show business at 50. I mean, you'd be some guy who was burned out and went off to become a house painter somewhere. So, I mean, that probably is another reason why he is so prolific, is because, you know, I think show business is one of those things where it's like your talent ages in dog years almost, where it's like your talent gets honed exponentially for every year that you're able to stay in that industry.
Well, the language of comedy is almost like you're speaking like Spanish or Latin or something like that. The only time you're as sharp is when you're immersed in the culture.
Right, right.
You know, it's like if you go to Spain, you're speaking Spanish, you're never more conscious of, you know, inflection and everything else. You know, you go away from it for a while, and yeah, you can write it down, but without that audience as the immediate feedback barometer, you're not really going to know where you are kind of, you know, currently in that universe.
Well, Black's also said that the way he writes his jokes is basically just start talking about stuff that annoys him and just rant about it until he thinks he's going to have a stroke and then stop. And so, honestly, for writing his books and stuff, he may just dictate everything. As things are occurring to him, he's driving around in his car and he picks up, and another thing.
He's stomping around the house with a dictaphone. all right, so this is probably where we should transition out of this, because we got to do the Name That Snack Volume 3 here in just a moment. So Humor Me Comedy 101, Mr. Big Jim Willick, who can be found somewhere on Facebook. It is the 7th of January, and I know you've said this like 1,000 times. Your show at the Baghdad is coming up.
It's actually next Friday.
Next Friday, at
the Baghdad. Yes, that is correct.
So we will talk a lot about that next Friday. What is Humor Me for next Friday going to be?
Margaret Cho.
Really?
Yes.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Man, I'm just going to stop the thoughts. I got a lot to say about Margaret Cho, so I'm going to throttle that back. You can find Jim Willig online. You can also see him next Friday night at the Baghdad. That is January 14th. So we'll talk more about that when that date arrives. Jim Willig and Humor Me, Comedy 101.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
All right, so as we plunge on ahead here, so we'll get to round three of Name That Snack here in just a moment. We will also, let's see, we should probably do, Don, what is your gut sense here on Corpse Watch versus Nazi Watch?
Well, the Nazi Watch is short-ish. I could do the Nazi Watch.
Where do you feel, in terms of quality, though? Does one strike you as inherently better than the other?
Yeah, let's do the Nazi Watch.
All right. So without further ado, ladies and gentlefolk, we have your Nazi Watch for, what is this? This is Friday, is it not? Mm-hmm. We have your Nazi Watch for Friday right here in the Rick Emerson radio program.
CBS presents this program in color.
I keep meaning to edit that beginning off, and I keep not doing it, and it keeps being funny.
Yeah.
Here's Don Taylor with your Nazi Watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Newly released documents reveal a previously unknown footnote in the history of the Nazis. For a period of time in 1941, they became enraged over reports that Tor Borg, a Finnish businessman, had a dog who his wife had named Hitler because of the strange way it raised its paw high in the air like Germans greeting the Führer.
Hitler?
I barely knew her.
Sorry. Borg was called to the German embassy to answer questions about the dog, but he denied he ever called him Hitler. The Germans never believed him and even considered steps they could take to destroy Borg's pharmaceutical wholesale company.
Oh, Jesus!
Boy, that's talk about the scorched earth policy.
There was talk of sending him to trial for insulting Hitler, but the plans were later dropped after witnesses said they could not repeat their accusations in front of a judge. Just months before the Nazis launched their attack on the Soviet Union, writes Klaus Hildebrand, a Nazi expert, they had nothing better to do than obsess about this dog.
I'm thinking nerve strike. I mean, so let me just understand this to make sure that I've got the story right. So they were obsessed about this guy named Tor. What's his name? Tor Borg?
Tor Borg.
And because his wife, they believed, may have had a dog.
Had called the dog Hitler because of the way it would raise its paw.
So in other words, it wasn't like they had the dog, and the dogs like they trained it to do that. It's not like they named the dog Hitler and then taught it to do this.
No,
it is that the dog did this somehow. Like it raised its hand to shake hands or something in the manner that reminded them of the Führer.
Right.
And so then they said, well, hey, why not? The dog himself is suggesting the name. Why don't we just name him Hitler?
Yeah, I think the dog originally was named Jackie, and then
That's a strange leap.
And then they
Jackie, we call it.
And
Hitler
here's a photograph of it, by the way. And then they nicknamed the dog Hitler because of
the dog wearing sunglasses.
What is? Yeah, I'm not sure why the dog's wearing sunglasses in the photo.
Is it a German Shepherd?
I couldn't tell
if that was humor right there or not.
It was six of one, half a dozen of the other. Actually,
wow. Okay.
They said a witness in Helsinki wrote. The vice consul in Helsinki wrote, a witness who does not want to be named said he saw and heard how Borg's dog reacted to the command Hitler by raising its paw. So,
you know, there's no pleasing, madmen dictators.
No.
You know, it's like the monkey in the Raiders of the Lost Ark doesn't raise his hand, they get angry. The dog does raise his hand, they get angry. There's just no making some people happy.
Yeah, ultimately, they didn't press charges against him, but apparently it was, according to these recently released documents, it was quite the big deal there for a while.
I love the idea that they were
going to
destroy his pharmaceutical company and bring him up on trial. I mean, I know this seems like an obvious point, but it really does suck to live underneath a guy like Adolf Hitler, because you just you never know. You just that's a thing. It's like having a really, really cranky next door neighbor, but who also has like nuclear first strike capability, where you're not quite certain what's going to set him off on any particular day.
Hitler didn't like Tor Borg, but the guy who had Goebbels the gerbil, oh, he loved that guy. Loved him to death.
There's your Nazi watch for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. All right. Wow. All right. Well, seems to be a series of unfortunate segues this week, so we're going to go right from Hitler to snack foods.
Okay.
And one of our many clients, E.H. Vending. And you can find out, I should probably get rid of the Hogan Heroes music as I'm playing this. You can find out more about E.H. Vending by going to ehvending.com. That is their website. You can also contact them via phone if you would like. You can contact Josh at 360-816-1853. That is 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. So if you are the decision maker, if you are an owner or operator of a business of any size, and if you are unhappy with your current vending provider, or if you found that maybe you only have a single outlet for your business, or a single retail location, or a single shop, or whatever it is that you're running, and you're having difficulty finding a vending company that wants to deal with a single outlet, or if you are wanting to maybe to scale back, your budget because of what with the economy and all, and you're just not having any luck finding somebody to meet your needs, they can handle this. They handle businesses of all sizes, all shapes, all varieties, and you can contact them at ehvending.com, or you can call them again at 360-816-1853. Apparently one of the...
And they fill their machines with a wide variety of delicious things, judging by the giant box of snacks they sent us.
You would not even know. I mean, you can't even... Your tiny mind cannot even conceive the greatness of the things in this box, which I am loath to describe because we might be using them for,
right,
you know, for future rounds. Because here's the thing, is that the listeners have been taking an average of, like, 1.5 clues to identify. Literally, the guy who nailed yesterday, he identified corn nuts from the sound of me crunching some. I said, here's the first clue. It's an auditory clue. Put it in my mouth, crunch immediately. Guy, within 30 seconds, corn nuts.
Well, corn nuts have a unique sound when being consumed. There's only two things that make that sound. There's corn nuts, and then there's Quarry, the breakfast cereal. Yeah. Those are the only two things that do it. I like Quarry because it's crunchy.
It is a simple matter to get in touch with EH Vending. Again, you can do it via their Vancouver number, 360-816-1853 or 503-897-8204. And we've talked a lot about the vending business in terms of the actual vending machines. They also do things like your coffee supply, your coffee setup. So you can go to a place and they got the coffee and all the fixins, as they say, right there. They can handle all of that. They can handle any combination of that you might need at your business or possibly at your home. So you can contact them via EH Vending. .com. All right, so now I'm actually not going to hold this up to the microphone again, but I will because I don't want to give too much away. But this is Jim. This will be the third snack that we are using for the people. Now, once again,
and this is not a clue because no one would know this, but I will say that as a teenager, that was one of my favorite snacks in the entire world.
Really?
Oh yes, I was quite fixated on this particular snack when I was about 14 years old for some reason.
All right, that's intriguing. So as we reveal more about this, or as it is guessed by somebody, I want to ask you about that. Because the thing about this particular snack is that, I don't know, I shouldn't say anymore. It's an interesting snack in many ways. So once again, the way we do this is via timestamp on the email. So it behooves you, if possible, to listen live to the program each day, because we do this by when the email arrives, sort of like a postmark. You send your answer to snack, that is S-N-A-C-K, snack at rickemerson.com, snack at rickemerson.com. The first person to correctly identify the snack to which we are referring when a gift basket of snacks and other delectable items from EH Vending. So here is your first clue. And again, we start with very broad, and we do one clue each weekday, narrowing down. The first clue is it comes in two flavors. Now, that is not mixed together. That is, it is available in two varieties.
Actually,
you can
I didn't
get
know
it
that.
Most people, but that is true. And I did not know it either, but that is a thing that I have discovered is in fact the case.
Huh.
So this is available in two different varieties. So it comes in two flavors. And that's it. That's all you're getting for today. So we'll do the second clue for round number three on Monday. So you want to be listening for that. That is brought to you by EHVending.com.
Guess this one on the first try. I dare ya.
Sons of bitches. All right.
Gary Glutton.
Well, we should probably wrap all this up now. So Jim Willig will be back again next Friday when he will also be having his show at the Baghdad. So we'll talk more about that. Join us Monday when our guests will include Mr. Ryan White from the Oregonian. Also next week, Mr. Aaron Mesh will be in the studio and so forth. Anything else we need to wrap up today? Anything else we need to do? Are we good? Have we got everything?
I got everything.
Such
I mean,
an insane
I had stories I wanted to do, but you know. Okay, I do have to share this before we go. It'll only take a couple of minutes.
Had a legion of news you wanted to do yesterday.
I know. So. Okay, I did want to share this because I loved this. The veterinary pet insurance company released their annual list of popular names for pets.
Because are you kidding?
They get all the names of the pets because people, you know, get insurance.
They register them and yeah.
The most popular name for dogs.
Hitler. Was
Bella.
Okay. Because
of the damn movie
Twilight.
The,
and your dog's name is Bella as well.
Yeah, but my dog's
because
like
of
6
Twilight
years
as well.
Old.
Yeah.
I named my dog Bella before.
That's
so
right.
It has nothing to do with that.
That's like the guy who just messaged in and said that I stole the prepaying my meal thing from Fight Club, which was not yet released at that time.
So, in general, people tend to give their animal friends people-ish sort of names. Cat and dog owners chose to name the names Lucy and Charlie. Those were high up.
Right.
Other top dog names are Bailey, Max, Lucy, Molly, Buddy, Maggie, Daisy, and Sophie. Cat owners chose Max, Colony, Oliver. But of course, they also take note of some of the more unusual names that people name their dogs, including, and these are some of my favorite for dogs, Badonkadonk, Ninja Star Danger Rock,
hyphenated
Lord Chubby Prune Face, and my personal favorite, Pickle Von Corn Dog. Among cats,
here's the thing: I don't believe anything in this story. That's the
I totally believe people name their animals things.
That's
like
in this country.
Yes, in the United States. So the top strange names for cats that they list are Miss Headbutter, Senor Nachos, and the other best name on the list, Admiral Pancake.
Okay, Admiral Pancake is awesome. That's fantastic. I can get with that. That doesn't make it. There's more here that we have time to even discuss. All right, so with that, we should bring today's program to a close. Following a little musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's somewhat odd edition of Legion of News. It'll all make sense when you hear it. Followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. High above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, at the news desk, Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kennedy. We want to thank our guest, Big Jim Willig, who will be back again next Friday, the 14th. As always, the Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you guys, so thank you each and everyone, and have a fantastic weekend. Be safe. We will see you all Monday. It is Friday, January 7th, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth.
Walk
bye now.
Dance.
Where are my bitches?
Jump. Go ahead and jump. Might as well jump.